Hi, welcome to the Innovation Exchange podcast. I'm Dr. Hassan Chauhan, your host. Today we're in a wet and windy Suffolk village with Dr. Liz O'Riordan and her dog Hunter. We're chatting to her about her journey as a patient and as a doctor with cancer and how that can help innovators shape the way they develop technology for the NHS. We know that every 2 minutes someone in the UK is diagnosed with cancer. Knowledge, diagnosis and treatment methods are improving every day. But what exactly are the groundbreaking innovations out there that could really change the lives of millions? Do we have to prioritise some areas of development over others? And do we really understand what patients need? Liz, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Liz, could you start by taking us through some of the current challenges facing the NHS in terms of cancer?
Wow, that's a big question. Let's start with diagnosis. I think one of the problems we face is a lot of people don't think they're ever going to get cancer. I never did. I was a breast cancer surgeon and I never checked my breasts. Things are slowly changing. I think one of the benefits of social media is that young cancer patients are now talking and blogging and being open and honest about what cancer is, and hopefully they're raising that awareness. But no one likes to talk about it.
I guess the issue for me is, you know, when you have patients who are diagnosed with cancer, one of the most difficult things for them, aside from coping with it and understanding it themselves, is having to tell loved ones or friends. So how do you think we're going to get through this barrier of trying to talk to people who don't really know anything about it?
I honestly don't know what the big answer is. It's really, really hard. There's no right or wrong way to tell people. When I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I told the world through Twitter the next day. My husband, I had to check with him because it would change both our lives. We just said, I can't not talk about this. I want the world to know. I wrote a book with Professor Tricia Greenhouse. She's a GP and an expert in statistics, and she didn't tell anybody. She came out 18 months later when she wrote a paper, but no one knew she had cancer all the way through treatment, and we were both very, very different. So we wrote a book to help people cope with breast cancer, but it's relevant to anybody going through it.
So we're here as part of the Innovation Exchange to talk about new and exciting ideas and particularly technology and how that's going to change cancer, both diagnosis and intervention and treatment. So where do you think you lie in terms of innovation, in terms of cancer? Can you see gaps at the moment that you think really aren't being addressed through innovation or through technology?
I think one of the problems facing cancer diagnosis at the moment in the UK is the massive shortage of radiologists. We don't have the doctors to read the scans that are being done, and that's creating a huge waiting list. It's a real problem. And when the delays build up, we're just creating worry and harm unnecessarily. And if you do have cancer, it means there's a delay. And I think that's where artificial intelligence and deep learning may be able to help doctors read the scans, get results to patients quicker.
Do you think we are doing worse as a country than we should compared to others?
I think the UK is doing pretty well, actually. There's new research released today by CRUK showing that the mortality rate of breast cancer has dramatically dropped over the last 30 years. Women are surviving for longer, and that's the development of new trials and new treatments and new drugs. And I think we are leading the way when it comes to cancer. But I think one of the problems is when it comes to talking about cancer, we're very good at the public health prevention, eat healthily, don't drink, exercise, look after yourself. That will stop you getting cancer. That's great. What we're not very good at is talking about metastatic cancer and research for those hundreds of thousands of people who are dying every day of cancer that can't be cured. And Breast Cancer Awareness Month is good at letting people know that actually metastatic patients aren't spending their last days in a hospice. Most people are living for 5-10 years, even living healthy lives. They are people worth investing money in. But, and this is going to be controversial, I think breast cancer gets an awful lot of awareness in the media. No one talks about anal cancer or vaginal cancer or kidney cancer or all the weird and wonderful blood cancers. And I think they all need to work together. Instead of one person trying to find the one drug to cure that one cancer, what if everybody could share that knowledge and you'd get research centres all over the UK sharing and combining for the greater good to help everybody?
That is pretty controversial. Fair enough. So I will ask you then, why do you think that is? Why is it that there's so much focus on breast cancer and perhaps lung cancer than there is on any other cancers?
I think part of it is the celebrity side of it. When famous people get diagnosed with cancer, there's suddenly a flurry, like with pancreatic cancer, when David Bowie and Alan Rickman had pancreatic cancer, suddenly there's a bit of a ruffle of this cancer exists. There's a huge driving force of women who are advocates for more research into breast cancer. They have a voice that can be heard. Plus, it's, how can I say this, pink cells. It's very easy to put a model on the cover of a magazine wearing a pink bra to raise money for breast cancer. It's a nice image. It looks good in the media. If you were to talk about colostomies or melanomas or people who've had their legs amputated, the public might not want to look at those kind of images. Okay. And these are just my thoughts. I don't know, but it's everywhere you look, it's breast cancer. And even in Bowel Cancer Month, there was still a breast cancer campaign. And yes, people are dying of breast cancer, but they're dying from other cancers too. The childhood cancers, we don't hear about those in the media.
So Liz, let's come back to you, okay? So let's talk to you about your patient journey, because it must have been difficult for you to be a surgeon, then become a patient, and then have to experience some of the things that you've been telling patients about. So being at the other side, how did that journey feel for you, and what did it teach you?
I thought I was an expert in breast cancer. I'd spent 20 years training to become a breast cancer surgeon. I even had a postgrad degree in it. And I didn't think I had breast cancer. I thought I had another cyst because I had normal scans 6 months before with a cyst. And I'm a breast surgeon. I should know what it feels like. And I didn't find out in the normal way. And that's partly due to technology. My mammogram was normal and I went to have an ultrasound and they put the probe on my breast and I turned to look at the screen because I was learning to do ultrasounds myself. And I saw a cancer. I knew it was a cancer. I knew it was big. I knew I'd need a mastectomy. I knew I'd probably need chemotherapy. I had a rough idea what my 10-year odds of surviving it were based on the size and my age. Most patients are drip-fed information. I couldn't not know what was in my brain. I had that knowledge. And it's almost from that moment I've been in denial. I still don't really believe I've had breast cancer twice. And I think part of me is protecting myself from what I've seen. I've seen the best and the worst of breast cancer. I know what might happen to me, and I really hope it doesn't, but it's hard to forget what you know. One of the hardest things for me about chemotherapy was constipation. I've spent years as a colorectal SHO writing out lactulose and Movicol and Fibogel, saying, thank goodness I never to drink that gunk. And after 10 days, crying on the toilet, straining with bleeding piles, having not been having to take those medicines, I just felt so ill and so sorry for myself, and I didn't get what it's like to have some treatment rob you of what felt like my pride, my dignity, my femininity. I had no control. I just had to let it happen. And that was really, really hard. I also didn't realise the collateral damage of treatment. And not only physical, so the fatigue, the chronic pain, the neuropathy, the hair loss, the bone ache, the menopause, dealing with the grief of losing your breasts, losing your hair, losing your fertility. But the mental side of it, anxiety, depression, PTSD, the scanxiety, the fear of recurrence, none of this I really knew about. I used to see patients and I'd see them at 2 weeks post-op. I'd see them at a year. I'd see them at 5 years. Off you go, job done, your scar looks great. I now know what it's like to live with the reality. And actually, it's almost hard when your doctor says goodbye. And you're living in this world of what is normal, what isn't. And that's where social media helped me. And I realised there's a whole world of information out there that patients have access to that as a doctor, I was completely ignorant to. I used to tell my patients, don't go on Google because it's scary. I'll tell you everything you need. The first thing I did was go on Google. And I'm a breast cancer surgeon. And you're there at 3 o'clock in the morning looking up scary blogs thinking, am I going to die? Between Trish and I, we bought 20 books of breast cancer, trying to find out how to cope with what was going to happen to us. Because doctors don't tell you. I didn't realise there were apps that would remind women to check their breasts in the middle of every monthly cycle. Or there were Macmillan apps to help you cope with the side effects of chemo that I wasn't told about by my team. But why would they know? Because they've never had cancer. And I think doctors are taught the clinical, the side effects, the how to treat cancer, but not how to help patients cope.
No, I think you're completely right on that last point, because as a GP, we have 10-minute consultations. I often sit there, and when you have the patients who've got multiple long-term conditions, you have 10 minutes. Yeah. OK, maybe I slip a bit and go a bit over, but 10 minutes to get some insight into what's troubling them and what's ailing them. And, you know, whether that's a chronic mental health problem or a chronic physical disability or even acute illness, I'm distinctly conscious of the fact that I'll speak to them for 10 minutes. Then the minute they're outside my door, I am having to focus on the next patient. They're outside of my mind. But that might be the only 10 minutes that person has had to talk about that problem. And that sometimes really weighs heavily on my mind.
I get what you're saying about not having time. And I would get 10 minutes to tell a woman she had breast cancer and talk about reconstruction. And you'd go over because you have to. And you could take an hour knowing there's a waiting room outside. And you don't really want to lift the lid on what all those patients' problems are, because you may be there for hours and they don't want to open it because they might break down. But it's the things like sex and work and money and exercise and how are you living with this illness, whereas as a doctor, you're just focusing on managing the symptoms of the illness and who is looking after everything else. I would now tell anybody, ask the patients, tell me what are the apps, what are the forums, what are you using to help you cope when I say goodbye? Can you put that in an email or a PDF that I can then hand out to people? These are a list of almost a digitally signpost. Patients know what's out there because they're using it every day. It'll be a quick and easy service development improvement project for anybody in any hospital. 1 in 4 people are diagnosed with cancer in A&E, alone, on a trolley, with nowhere to go. Well, if you could say, right, the first thing you're going to do is go on your phone. Here's a list of helpful websites. This is where you tell your mum to go. So you're not explaining what leukemia is. She can go and have a look and pass it on to your gran. We could help people that way.
Liz, do you think it's possible that actually there are too many places to get that information and perhaps even it's too accessible? So we know NHSX have made arrangements with Amazon Echo to be able to provide health advice through your Echo Dot. As a GP, I've often said, you know, that granny role is missing from families now in terms of being able to ask your granny what she thinks. So do you think actually there's too much information out there?
I do. I think almost a voice of common sense and reason. If you have a cold, you take paracetamol, you know, you go to bed for a couple of hours rather than going on the phone and going to the pharmacist and going to A&E. And I think we've lost that. How do you look after normal illnesses and just learn you will feel ill at some point, and that's okay. It's that instant access. I want to know what it is now. And the internet is only as accurate as the information you get it. And we all know from being doctors, a patient tells you a story and it's only the fifth time when they talk to the consultant, they remember that one piece of information. And I think patients can be dangerous getting information from the internet. And there's a bit of, do you keep searching until you find what you want to hear? Or do you wait until you get what you need to hear? Does that make sense? A bit like a second opinion. I want someone to tell me that I should eat an apple for breakfast, so I'm going to go to 50 websites until I find the one that justifies what I want.
What about the role of technology in this, though, Liz? Do you think it's productive? Do you think it's helpful? Or do you think actually it's a barrier and actually becoming difficult to try and help patients get to the right place?
I think the technology has done wonders for opening up the medical world to patients. When I was training, it felt very much like, I'm the doctor, I have control of all your information, I am the expert, I will tell you what to do. And as a patient, I suddenly realise I'm the one who's had the MRI and the blood tests, and why can't I get my data? Why don't I have my scans? It belongs to me. Who says my data belongs to the doctor? And as a doctor, I may have treated 300 women with breast cancer in a year, but I'm not an expert in any of them. And I've got across the patients coming with leaflets printed off the internet thinking, oh God, here we go, it's another difficult patient. But I've now been that patient. And I found a trial where I thought I could have another chemo drug that might keep me alive a bit longer. And I felt awful going to my oncologist asking, have you heard about this trial? Could you look at it? But why should I? And I think it's great. It's opening up the playing field so you can find out what's happening. In the States, patients go to every conference and they tweet and they know far more about immunotherapy than I ever did as a UK breast surgeon. And I think that's good. I think another bit of technology that's coming is the artificial intelligence. It's like industry is changing. Computer encoding didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. We don't know where medicine will be. Alexa knows I had breast cancer before my mum did because it's the first thing you put in Google. I think patients are quite scared about technology and medicine and who will have control of our data and who is it being sold to. So if Apple Health knows you have an irregular heart rate, is that data being sold on to another company? And I think any technology firm needs to make sure that data is protected.
So the old saying is that we're data rich, information poor. And I get that patients really are the experts. But do you think, so with doctors, with medicine, with research, with studies, you can regulate it, you can get ethical approval, and you can go through all sorts of standards to try to make sure that what you're doing is accurate. But with the internet, with using patient experiences, it's a whole new world, isn't it, which can be entirely unregulated. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a huge problem. There's no real code of conduct or governance for AI and technology, although it has been developed. Is it the Eric Topol has done a review with the NHS? He has, hasn't it? Yeah. So there's now a code of conduct and governance for any new tech company about how data should be stored and it shouldn't be sold. And ideally, patients should be involved at the beginning of any startup involved in artificial intelligence and healthcare.
So let's talk about AI. Do you think all this technology is positive, or do you think actually it is getting to the point of perhaps over-diagnosing?
I think that's a risk with any scan that you do on anybody. There's always a chance. We used to call them incidental omas. Yep. I think one of the good things about artificial intelligence reading scans is they're based on pattern recognition. They don't get tired. They can have a far faster output than a doctor can. And you may have a consultant reading a scan who's been a consultant for 6 months compared to a consultant who's been in post for 20 years. One of the problems, though, is that they may get more accurate and better at picking up smaller and smaller things. And they may be things that don't need to be treated, particularly in the breast cancer world. You have the pre-cancer called DCIS. And if you start picking up tiny millimeters of low-grade DCIS, what do you do? And I think that's the problem. You want them to get good, but not too good, because we don't have the evidence to say, how do we treat these tiny lesions?
Liz, earlier on, you talked about the social isolation and loneliness associated with a cancer diagnosis or indeed any long-term condition. Do you think technology has a role to play in tackling that?
I think Twitter saved my life. And that's a really dramatic thing to say, but honestly, I didn't think I used Twitter a lot, mainly triathlons and baking, and didn't think I could go 9 months not talking about it. I didn't see another patient physically for the whole of my 9 months of treatment, but through Twitter, through forums, through apps, through WhatsApp, I was able to talk and communicate with people who got it. People who were having chemo on the same day as me, I could share my experiences, they could share their tips to help me treat them. And it literally saved my life. I've made friends for life who understand where I'm going through. And I think that's where technology can really, really help cancer patients. Your family get it and they understand and they want to be there for you, but they can't really, really know those feelings that you're too scared to share with anybody. And for me, the internet was a game changer.
So Liz, having gone through all that experience, you know, we've talked about diagnosis in terms of technology for that, in terms of, say, AI screening. We've talked about social isolation and support groups, be it apps. What about the other end of this now, which is treatment and recovery? How do you think technology can facilitate that?
I think technology is changing the way people operate. For example, 3D models can help you visualize when you're bringing in flaps and reconstructing breasts, and the laparoscopic surgery, the robotic surgery. I think that's going to be a game changer. We're doing more and more non-invasive surgery, getting people out of hospital quicker, and I think that's a really, really good thing. Radiotherapy has greatly improved again with the new CT scans, so you have much better 3D mapping, so you use less of the heart and the lung fields, and that's being really focused. And I think technology is great there. I don't think what anybody is very good at is helping patients when their hospital treatment is finished and they go back to the community, and that comes back to the support in primary care and moving on.
Liz, increasingly I see patients who have gone through that journey and, you know, fortunately are at the end where they're perhaps cured, and they'll come to me and they'll say, well, I feel like I'm lost now. I had this whole journey, I had this whole support. Now I'm cured. I got kicked out of the oncologist's door and it's, see ya, good luck, enjoy the rest of your life. And they feel completely lost. How do we keep that link with the person who was involved in your care and use technology perhaps to try and make it so?
I didn't realise how hard it was for patients when the doctor says goodbye. But when I think it's worse when you've had a lot of intensive treatment like chemo. You're so hospitalised every 3 weeks, and then suddenly it's see you in a year, see you in 5 years. And you do go, what's next? I think part of it is education. So it's educating patients. And almost the secondary and the primary care talking to say, right, okay, who is telling the patients what they need to know? Where do they go when they find a problem? I used to think we had an open access clinic. So if a patient of mine had a cough they were worried about, they could ring the breast care nurse and the breast care nurse could bring them into clinic. But they can't because the money has to follow the patient. So we have to say, go back and see the GP. And then it's lucky if you have an educated GP who thinks your cough may be a metastatic symptom to then refer you back in. And patients just feel they don't know where to go. And that's where I think primary and secondary care communicating and saying, right, we agree between us that every patient who is discharged knows what symptoms to look out for and knows how long to wait. So if you have a cough for 4 weeks that isn't getting better, then you make an appointment to see the GP. So there's a clear plan.
I agree completely. And I think there's two points there. The first is your theme of empowering the patient. I think we should completely do that because actually you're living with the symptoms. And if we can educate them in terms of signs and symptoms to look out for, then they'll be able to express that when they see the GP. Because however good the GP is, you know, sometimes that might not be on your mind when you have somebody who's had breast cancer 5-10 years ago. You might not think about it.
You can't say it's nothing. You have to send them in. And I used to see 16-year-old girls with a one-day history of breast pain sent into a cancer clinic because there's that 19-year-old girl in the Daily Mail. GPs are panicked because you have that pressure, and I get it. And most people I would see in my breast cancer clinic don't have breast cancer. But I can only say it's not by examining them and scanning them, which a GP can't do.
Liz, do you think technology can sometimes get it badly wrong?
Yes, I do. I think technology and programs and apps are only as good as the information put into them. And there's a lot of good, there's a lot of bad information out there. And patients can believe this. If the government is saying this is a great app, then it must be right. And you have that blind faith. And I think it's very hard for the public to know what they should trust and what they shouldn't. Whilst we're waiting for things to change, for new technologies to be developed to help with scans and treatment in the future, let's use what's out there at the moment. You could change millions of lives overnight.
I'm sure you could. And I don't want to go down this path, but I was going to say about patient access in terms of information, because I know that actually there's a wealth of information for a patient on the server, which I hold. And actually, we talked about it earlier on, didn't we? Whose property is that? Is it my property? Is it the patient's property? And even when it comes to giving the patient access, it comes to me to say, am I happy to share this with the patient? Should I be removing some things or protecting some things from them? And that's completely the wrong approach.
It is. I describe it a bit like this. Let's say you wanted to buy a car and you needed money to put down a deposit, and you ring up the bank and you say, how much money is in the account? And they say, it's okay, you're in credit. You go, but how much? Don't worry about that, you're in credit. By a pound or by 10,000 pounds? No, you don't need to know, you're just in credit. And we assume patients won't understand the numbers or the blood results. Everyone's got Google and Wikipedia, and if they want to find out, they will. During chemotherapy, you don't need to know your bloods are normal. You need to know how normal they are to know how close you are to missing a treatment. But you're not given the numbers because I won't understand.
I completely agree with that point as well. In terms of bloods or investigations, actually, you're the one who's going to be anxious to get that result and to be able to chase it and to be able to make sure it's done and reported in time for your appointment.
So here's something crazy. If you have a blood test in a hospital, you can often get the results back in half an hour for a simple full blood count in UNE. And often for a lot of patients, they have blood taken in the morning and they get the results, if they're lucky, 24 hours later from the doctor, if they remember to ask the doctor to tell them. A day waiting in a hospital to get the results are the only thing that's happened to them. What if patients had... Now, there's a problem when it comes to results that may be cancer markers or cancer scans. And I think then doctors should be given 1, 2, 3 weeks, especially on an outpatient basis, to tell patients they have cancer. In the States, you find out over the phone, and that's a whole other issue whether you should or not. But I just think patients should have access to their results.
That does bring us back to the information education, doesn't it, in terms of results? Because often when we have patients have access to their results, you know, I'll get somebody ring me up and say, what does it mean that my neutrophil count is 0.01 over the upper threshold? Should I be worried about it? Is this cancer? Is this something that's going to be terminal? That's the tricky part in all of this, isn't it? The negotiation of what is normal, what is abnormal.
And it may be you have links to results saying, you know, click on what is a neutrophil, what does it mean, when you should be worried, so they can get that instantly by link on the result on a web page rather than having to ring a GP. But I compare this. My sister-in-law had a mammogram in Switzerland, and within half an hour, she had an email with a hyperlink to her file, the image and the result. In the UK, for a screening mammogram, you wait 3 weeks to get a letter telling you it's normal.
Stunned silence. Wow, that's fantastic, isn't it? There are some challenges, aren't there, with the system that we've got in England, in that we've got to operate within the confined resources that we have.
Yeah.
We know that with diagnosing, you've got to have the mammogram. It's got to then sit there for a radiologist to look at. I don't know how many images that radiologist has to look at. I don't know what the margin of error is. If you've looked at five in a row, then does it start to blur? Do you get tired? Are you going to miss the 1 millimeter fleck of calcium that actually could be very, very significant for that patient? So perhaps that's where technology could protect us and give us that advantage. Understanding, of course, that sometimes there are elements of overdiagnosis, as we talked about earlier on. But definitely, I think that's the way for the future, isn't it? So earlier this week, I spoke to several innovators who've been inspired by some of the challenges we've talked about, and they've come up with some interesting solutions. Hi, is that Raina?
Hi, yes, it's Raina.
Raina, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about Vine Health. Could you start by just telling us a little bit about the company?
Yes, of course. So Vine Health is a digital platform to support cancer patients as they go through treatment.
Okay. And what sort of outcomes are you seeing or feedback are you getting from users at the moment?
I mean, there's a very consistent thing that people going through cancer say, and that's that their care is incredibly complex, that they often feel in the dark and don't really know what's going on, and that they don't feel in control. And so that's really what we built this product to address. And I think that was one of the wonderful things about running the beta test that we did earlier this year, is that we really felt that we'd built something that people that helped people feel in control. And so we know with that beta test that almost everyone used the product on a weekly basis or more frequently than that. And the majority of people used it daily. And really, they were using that to track their symptoms, understand their medications, and use features that we hadn't even anticipated would be a big feature in their enjoyment of it. So we're really encouraged by those results, and we're looking forward to launching it again in a couple of months' time.
Raina, one of the things I was thinking about when I looked at the Vine app was really it brings all these other data sources together, like you said, about from tracking your wearables and putting in your appointments and those sorts of things. Is it quite labor intensive for an individual to set this all up, or actually is it quite slick and easy?
Yeah, we've made it incredibly easy. So we've made sure that you can enter in your entire chemotherapy cycle, no matter what that is, in one go. And we've mapped out every single iteration of the way that you can prescribe chemotherapy in this country, so that it's all there and all you have to do is select the one that applies to you. So lots of kind of products in this space allow you to add a medication or track that medication. But what we've done is put the entire thing in as a regime, as a complete cycle, as a set of cycles.
Okay. And I'm particularly interested in the social networking component of it. I think that's a little bit hit and miss at the moment out there, isn't it? Where some people who are very pro-social networking and some people very anti it in terms of increasing isolation. But I think if you choose a right cohort, it's entirely a very practical and useful suggestion. Have you had any thoughts or feedback on that part of this of the app?
Yeah, it's a feature that's coming soon. It's not one we've built into this first version, but we know it's important to people. And there are particular subtypes of cancer and particular age demographics who've often said to us, you know, I've never met anyone my age with my cancer. And that can make you feel incredibly alone. And particularly if it's a time when you're feeling terrible and you're not seeing your normal social kind of circle as much as you would, feeling connected to someone and feeling connected to people who understand what you're going through is really important.
And have you had much buy-in from clinicians, from doctors, therapists at the other side in terms of working with you on the app or working with their patients?
Yeah, we really have. And that's my background as a clinician. And it was something that I saw from the other end. You know, you have such a short period of time with patients. You often don't get to deliver information in a way that people can ask as many questions as they want or have time to process it. Or, you know, people are stressed and vulnerable when they come into an appointment and often don't take in that information, understandably. And so being able to deliver that outside of the healthcare setting or in bite-sized chunks at a time when you're at home and comfortable, I think everyone realizes the importance of that. And on top of that, patients within the app can consent for their clinician to see their data. And that's not so that people can check up on you, but more that firstly, you can facilitate better conversations. So often when people go and see their doctor, they don't quite know how to summarize everything that's happened, or they don't know how to express it or what that doctor will be interested in. Through the app, we make it really clear to understand how your symptoms have been trending, what the changes have been, what the kind of categories of symptoms are that you might tell your doctor about, and the questions that you might ask. And so our goal was really to make that communication between the patient and the clinician much easier. And that's I think, why oncologists and clinicians have been so interested.
That's really a sign of things to come. As you know, more and more hospitals or outpatient departments now are looking to get rid of the traditional model of dragging people up for their outpatient follow-ups and starting to do more on phones and using technology. And so something like this really, really fits into that niche quite nicely, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It ties into a lot of the priorities from government and from NHS England in terms of the long-term plan and the legacy of the five-year forward view. So stratifying cancer patients, understanding what the different risk levels are, what kind of tools we can give people to help them self-manage and help them feel in control, and how we can follow people up in a light touch way or in a way that is more convenient for them is really important.
So Raina, what are next steps for you and specifically for VineApp now?
Yeah, so we're really excited to be launching in January. That's kind of the first stage of making this available to as many people as would benefit from it. And so right now we're looking for NHS partners to work with to roll this into oncology services, and also anyone who is going through cancer who might benefit from this, for them to get in touch, sign up through our website and feedback to us on whether they like it and what's useful. But we've had such great engagement from the cancer community so far, so we're really excited about being able to put this out into the public now.
Excellent. I hope this gets you some bandwidth, and I'm really excited to see the future for the VineApp, Raina. Thanks
very
much.
Next, I spoke to Eric de Hoys from Skin Vision, based in the Netherlands.
Hi, is that Eric?
Yes, this is Eric speaking.
Thanks very much, Eric, for joining us today to talk to us about Skin Vision. I'm really excited about this app. Could you tell me a little bit more about how Skin Vision works?
Yes, Skin Vision, first of all, has the purpose to have people identify dangerous spots on their body, dangerous lesions, and take a photo of these spots using their own camera. So they can do this done in the comfort of their own home. And after they've taken a photo with Skin Vision, they get an immediate feedback on the danger of the spot. It's either high risk or low risk. And when people get a high risk response, we give them a recommendation to go to the doctor or to keep monitoring the spot if there is a potential risk for changes. And the objective is actually to make sure that the right people go to the right doctor in the right time, avoiding a lot of delayed treatment on one side, or unnecessary doctors.
Excellent. So what sort of stage of development are you at? Have you got the finished product, or do you think it still needs tweaks?
Of course, Skin Vision is always in development. When we started in 2012, we have done different clinical trials in Munich, in LMU, and in Eindhoven, with the hospital in Eindhoven, clinic in Eindhoven, where we identified that what the purpose of Skin Vision is that is actually working. And after those trials, we have been starting to market and, of course, continued our further evidence of the claims that we make with different studies as well.
Right. And Eric, on your website, it quotes a large number of users and a large number of photos that have been taken. Where are these normally based? Have you found that the app is being used nationally, or is it located more around those sorts of pilot sites that you did your research in?
The customers that we service are mainly coming from Australia, New Zealand, Netherlands, Germany, and the UK. So basically, these are the larger numbers of customers coming to us.
Excellent. And what's the sort of technology you're using for Skin Vision, Eric?
It started out at the beginning as a rule-based algorithm. And because of our active use of the service, we are able to collect enough data points to create a full machine learning-based network which is now in place and has an accuracy of 95% sensitivity on all forms of skin cancer. So this is highly accurate. And this this allows to further market the service to health systems like NHS, but also insurance companies like Generali, CZ in the Netherlands, and other insurance companies that are providing skin vision to their users as part of the reimbursed system.
Right. And so I guess that leads me on to what sort of stage are you at the moment? Are you looking now at a bigger rollout, or are we still in the trying to embed it, trying to identify where it sits phase?
Yeah, we know where it sits, and it allows customers to make the right assessments in the comfort of their own home. And part of our focus, of course, is to further develop the service, because this is a continuous process. But we are looking at deploying skin vision in a fairly large way in the different health systems, because we believe that we can really support the end users finding different dangerous spots, but also the care systems where there is high pressure on dermatology, high pressure on sensitivity on the GP level, where doctors are uncertain about what spot they are looking at and if this is really something that needs to be taken care of by a dermatologist, and unnecessary referrals are very high in different markets. So this is where we believe we can start to roll out the service to larger health systems.
Excellent. So I understand that completely, and I see the benefit in picking up cancers and conditions. Do you have any idea how many save clinic times? So for example, you might say, we know that in an average month, for example, 60% of images that were taken with skin vision were low risk, and so people were reassured, and so that means that equates to X number of saved visits to a clinician.
So we have done some specific calculations on that can lead to substantial savings of about 80% of people that otherwise would have either not get an answer, are actually prevented to go to the doctor.
Excellent. So that means the patient gets a good service in terms of their concern about their skin lesion, and at the same time we're saving clinic resources. So it's really a win-win. And so bearing all this in mind, Eric, what are the next steps for skin vision and yourself?
Yeah, the next step for skin vision is to work with the different stakeholders in the UK to become part of the UK healthcare pathway and healthcare system, just like we are in the Netherlands.
Wow, it looks like you really are going from strength to strength over there, aren't you, Eric? Have you got any advice for other people in a similar position in terms of startups or new innovations, bearing in mind, you know, your growth so far?
Yes, so the real tips that I can give to make sure that the clinical evidence is at the level which can support the objectives that you have, in our case, finding skin cancer in the early phase, to make sure that the financial benefits and the place within the care path is really taken care of and understood, and that there are ways to reimburse the service in such a way that it is not conflicting with any other provider of services, and maybe give real-life evidence of people using the service and giving their feedback and their referrals, in order to motivate people what the service can do and the power of the service at hand.
Excellent. Thank you.
And finally, I spoke to Tal Freeman from IBEX.
Hi, is that Tal?
Yes, hi.
Tal, thanks so much for joining us today to talk to us about IBEX. Can you start by telling us a little bit more about IBEX?
Yeah, sure. So we have completed development of our first product, which is used to analyze prostate biopsies. We started selling it quite recently to hospitals and pathology labs worldwide.
So how does this actually work?
So maybe the right way to describe it would be to talk a little bit before that about the important clinical challenge that we try to meet.
Okay.
Most cancers are diagnosed by pathologists that analyze biopsies. Biopsies are small pieces of tissue suspected as being malignant, taken from, for example, from the breast, prostate, or other organs. For well over 100 years, pathologists used to analyze biopsies using a microscope. But today, they find themselves challenged to provide accurate and timely analysis. Like any person, pathologists make mistakes, they get tired, and in addition to that, the increasing life expectancy together with advancement in medicine leads to an ever-increasing number of tests. The number of pathologists, however, is decreasing, and most pathology labs are understaffed. There's just not enough pathologists to meet demand. We at IBEX decided that these challenges are a real opportunity for us. So we've put together this team of machine learning experts, algorithm developers, data scientists, and physicians, and we were able to develop algorithms that detect cancer as accurately as a human pathologist.
So Tal, what sort of technology are we using here?
So we use machine learning technologies to train an algorithm to identify particular cell types. For instance, we take a large number of cancerous biopsies and ask a human pathologist to mark in advance the locations of the cancerous cells on that biopsy. We feed it to the algorithm and do that enough times in the right order with the right team, of course, and you'll end up with a good algorithm that can identify cancer from benign biopsies.
Ah, excellent. Okay. Yeah, I understand that. What do you think are the benefits of IBEX for the health sector?
Benefits are twofold. By using an automated cancer diagnosis solution, we're helping pathologists in reducing error rates. We're also helping them to improve operational efficiency by reducing the average time spent on a case.
So at the moment, it looks like it's been, you know, IBEX has been developed with the help of pathologists to look at prostate cancer samples. That sounds like it's really useful then going forwards and probably could be expanded, I'm sure.
We also move into other tissue. After completing our successful launch of the algorithm for prostate, we will present algorithms for new tissue types in the coming year.
So back to you, Liz. What are your thoughts about these innovations?
I think these three innovations are fantastic because they're helping patients take control of their symptoms or they're solving a real-life problem that we have. My worry is that a lot of innovations are done to make money and jump on the AI tech bandwagon, and they're not fixing problems that are actually crippling the NHS at the moment. If you were talking about bowel problems with a drug, and you may say, ask the patients, have you had constipation today? Now, I'd ask you, what would you call constipation?
Oh, you're actually asking
me?
Oh, okay. No, you're more than welcome. So essentially for me, as an individual, constipation would be if I'm used to opening my bowels every day and I don't open them every day, then I'm constipated.
Okay. You could get someone with Crohn's disease who used to going 8 times a day. So going once a day is constipation, whereas someone is used to going once a week. So going once a fortnight is constipation. It's a medical word, but patients don't get it. Getting patients involved from the very beginning will make sure that you are on track, you're listening to them, you're listening to their voice and helping them develop it. Because the whole point of the NHS is to help the general public and the patients.
So the key to this, if I understand, is trying to find a technological solution to something that has arisen from a patient's concern or a patient's idea, rather than necessarily a group of software engineers who are sitting in a room thinking, that looks like a great idea and that's something we could develop. That's essentially what we're saying?
Well, I think it's both. I think software companies may have a great idea about helping scans being read, but I think they need to have patients on board. I read a book by Eric Topol, who's an American cardiologist, called The Patient Will See You Now. And I read it before I had breast cancer and I read it after, and it blew my mind. And he says, with the world of smartphones and people being able to do ultrasounds and get ECG tracings, patients may be able to scan themselves in the future and get the answer. But he said, the patient is the single most unused resource in healthcare. And I think we are the experts in our bodies. And if you just use us, we will be able to help you.
That's a great way to end it. Empower the patient and know that you don't know everything. Thank you, Liz.